Waiting at the curb were two matching silver Land Rovers.
Here, pile all your luggage into this one. It's going straight to the hotel. We can all ride in the other one without being cramped.
The driver in the first car got out, nodded to Colin, and went to join the other driver, leaving an empty car for them. In her jet-lagged fog, Rachel didn't know what to make of all this and just climbed into the back seat of the SUV.
What a treat! I don't think I've been welcomed at the airport like this since I was a little kid, Nick said, recalling the times in his childhood when a large group of family members would gather at the airport.
A visit to the airport back then was a thrilling event, since it also meant that his father would take him for a hot fudge sundae at the Swenson's ice cream parlor in the old terminal. People seemed to go away on longer trips back then, and there were always tears from the women saying goodbye to relatives heading overseas or welcoming home children who had spent the school year abroad. He once even overheard his older cousin Alex whisper to his father just before Harry Leung was about to board a plane, "Be sure to pick me up the latest penthouse on your layover in Los Angeles." Colin settled behind the wheel and began adjusting the mirrors to fit his sight lines.
"Where to? Straight to the hotel, or is it makan time?"
"I could definitely eat something," Nick said.
He turned around to look at Rachel, knowing she probably wanted to go straight to the hotel and collapse into bed.
"Feeling okay, Rachel?"
"I'm great," Rachel replied. "Actually, I'm kind of hungry, too."
"It's breakfast time back in New York, that's why," Colin noted.
"Did you have a good flight? Did you watch a lot of movies?"
Araminta asked.
"Rachel went on a Colin Firth binge," Nick announced.
Araminta squealed.
"OMG, I love him. He'll always be the one and only Mr. Darcy for me."
"Okay, I think we can be friends now," Rachel declared. She looked out the window, amazed by the swaying palm trees and profusion of bougainvillea that lined the sides of the brightly lit highway. It was almost 10 o'clock at night, but everything about this city seemed unnaturally bright, effervescent almost.
"Nikki, where should we take Rachel for her first local meal?"
Colin asked.
Should we welcome Rachel with a feast of Hainanese chicken rice at Chatterbox,
or should we head straight for chili crab at East Coast?"
Nick asked, feeling excited and torn at the same time. There were about 100 different eating places he wanted Rachel to experience right now.
"How about some satay?" Rachel suggested.
Nick is always going on and on about how you've never tasted decent satay until you've had it in Singapore.
"That settles it. We're going to Lau Pa Sat," Colin announced. "Rachel, you'll get to experience your first true hawker center, and they have the best satay."
"You think so? I like that place in Sembawang better," Araminta said.
"No, what are you talking about, La? The fellow from the original satay club is still at Lau Pa Sat,"
Colin said insistently.
"You're wrong," Araminta replied firmly. "That original satay club guy moved to Sembawang."
"Lies! That was his cousin, an imposter!"
Colin was adamant.
"Personally, I've always liked the satay at Newton," Nick cut in.
"Newton? You've lost your mind, Nikki. Newton is only for expats and tourists. There aren't any good satay stalls left," Colin said.
"Welcome to Singapore, Rachel.
We're arguing about food as the national pastime," Araminta declared.
"This is probably the only country in the world where grown men can get into fistfights over which specific food stall in some godforsaken shopping center has the best rendition of some obscure fried noodle dish. It's like a pissing contest."
Rachel giggled. Araminta and Colin were so funny and down-to-earth, she liked them both instantly. Soon they were on Robinson Road, in the heart of the downtown financial district. Nestled in the shadows of massive towers was Lau Pa Sat, or Old Market in the Hokkien dialect, an octagonal open-air pavilion that housed a bustling hive of food stalls. Walking from the car park across the street, Rachel could already smell the delicious, spice-filled aromas wafting through the balmy air. As they were about to enter the great food hall, Nick turned to Rachel and said,
"You're going to go nuts for this place. It's the oldest Victorian structure in all of Southeast Asia."
Rachel stared up at the soaring cast iron filigree arches that radiated out across the vaulted ceilings.
"Looks like the inside of a cathedral," she said.
"Where the masses come to worship food," Nick quipped.
Sure enough, even though it was past 10, the place teemed with hundreds of fervent diners.
Rows and rows of brightly lit food stalls offered up a greater array of dishes than Rachel had ever witnessed under one roof. As they walked around, peering at the various stalls where men and women were frenziedly cooking their delicacies, Rachel shook her head in awe.
"There's just so much to take in. I don't know where to start."
"Just point to whatever looks interesting and I'll order it," Colin offered. "The beauty of the hawker center is that each vendor basically sells just one dish, so whether it's fried pork dumplings or fishbowl soup, they've spent a lifetime perfecting it."
"More than one lifetime. A lot of these people are second and third generation hawkers, cooking old family recipes," Nick chimed in.
A few minutes later, the four of them were seated just outside the main hall, under a huge tree strung with yellow lights, every inch of their table covered with colorful plastic plates piled high with the greatest hits of Singaporean street cuisine. There was the famous jak wei tiao, a fried omelet with oysters called orlak, Malay rojak salad bursting with chunks of pineapple and cucumber, Hokkien-style noodles in a thick garlicky gravy, a fish cake smoked in coconut leaves called ota ota, and 100 sticks of chicken and beef satay. Rachel had never seen anything like this feast. "This is insane. Every dish looks like it came from a different part of Asia."
"That's Singapore for you. The true originators of fusion cuisine," Nick boasted.
"You know, because of all the ships passing through from Europe, the Middle East, and India in the 19th century, all these amazing flavors and textures could intermingle." As Rachel tasted the jak wei tiao, her eyes widened in delight at the rice noodles flash-fried with seafood, egg, and bean sprouts in a dark soy sauce. "Why doesn't it ever taste like this at home?"
"Gotta love that burned wok flavor," Nick remarked.
"I bet you'll love this," Araminta said, handing Rachel a plate of roti prata. Rachel tore off some of the doughy golden pastry and dipped it into the rich curry sauce.
"Mmm, heaven."
Then it was time for the satay. Rachel bit into the succulent grilled chicken, savoring its smoky sweetness carefully. The rest of them watched her intently.
"Okay, Nick, you were right. I've never had decent satay until now."
"To think you doubted me," Nick tut-tutted with a smile.
"I can't believe we're pigging out at this hour,"
Rachel giggled, reaching for another stick of satay.
"Get used to it. I know you probably want to go straight to bed, but we have to keep you up for a few more hours so that you'll adjust better to the time change," Colin said.
Colin just wants to monopolize Nick for as long as possible," Araminta declared. "These two are inseparable whenever Nick's in town."
"Hey, I have to make the most out of this time, especially since Mommy Dearest is away," Colin said in his own defense. "Rachel, you're in luck not having to deal with Nikki's mum the minute you arrive."
"Colin, don't you start scaring her," Nick chided.
"Oh, Nick, I almost forgot. I ran into your mum the other day at Churchill Club," Araminta began. "She grabbed me by the arm and said,
'Araminta, ayo, you're too dark. You better stop going into the sun so much, otherwise on your wedding day, you will be so black, people would think you are Malay.'"
Everyone roared with laughter except Rachel.
"She was kidding, I hope."
"Of course not. Nick's mum doesn't kid," Araminta said, continuing to laugh.
"Rachel, you'll understand once you meet Nikki's mum. I love her like my own mother, but she's one of a kind," Colin explained, trying to put her at ease. "Anyway, it's perfect that your parents are gone, Nick, because this weekend, your presence is required at my bachelor party."
"Rachel, you'll have to come to my bachelorette party," Araminta declared.
"Let's show the boys how it's really done."
"You bet," Rachel said, clinking her beer with Araminta's. Nick gazed at his girlfriend, thrilled that she had so effortlessly charmed his friends. He could still hardly believe that she was actually here with him and that they had the whole summer ahead of them.
"Welcome to Singapore, Rachel," he joyously declared, lifting up his bottle of tiger beer in a toast.
Rachel gazed into Nick's sparkling eyes. She had never seen him as happy as he was tonight, and she wondered how she could possibly have been worried about coming on this trip.
"How does it feel to be here?" Colin asked.
"Well," Rachel mused, "an hour ago we landed in the most beautiful modern airport I've ever seen, and now we're sitting under these huge tropical trees by a 19th century food hall,
having the most glorious feast. I don't ever want to leave.
Nick grinned broadly, not noticing the look Araminta had just given Colin. Chapter 15. Astrid, Singapore. Whenever Astrid felt in need of a pick-me-up, she would pay a visit to her friend Stephen. Stephen had a small jewelry shop on one of the upper levels of the Paragon Shopping Center, tucked away from all the other high-end boutiques in a back hallway. While it lacked the visibility of high-profile local jewelers like L'Orient or Larry Jewelry, with their gleaming flagship stores, Stephen Chia Jewels was highly regarded by the island's most discerning collectors. Not to disregard his studied eye for spectacular gemstones, but what Stephen truly offered was absolute discretion. His was the sort of niche operation where, for instance, a society matron in need of a quick cash infusion to pay off her idiot son's bad margin calls might go to dispose of an heirloom bauble without anyone finding out, or where a very important piece about to go on the block in Geneva or New York might be flown in for private inspection by a VIP client, away from the eyes of gossipy auction house staffers. Stephen's shop was said to be a particular favorite of the wives of Persian Gulf sheikhs, Malay sultans, and the Indonesian Chinese oligarchs, who had no need to be seen buying up millions of dollars worth of jewelry at the Tony Orchard Road boutiques. The shop consisted of a very small, rather stark front room where three French Empire vitrines displayed a small collection of moderately priced pieces, mainly by emerging artists from Europe. The mirror door behind the boule desk, however, hid a vestibule where another security door opened to reveal a narrow corridor of individual chambers. It was here that Astrid liked to hide out, in the tuberose-scented private salon lined from floor to ceiling in pale blue velvet, with its plush velvet recamier settee, where she could curl up her feet, sip a soda with lemon, and gossip with Stephen as he came in and out of the room bearing trays and trays of glorious gems. Stephen and Astrid had met years ago in Paris, when she wandered into the jewelry shop on Rue de la Paix, where he was doing his apprenticeship. Back then, it was as rare to meet a teenage Singapore girl interested in 18th century cameos as it was to see a young Chinese man behind the counter at a joaillier, as distinguished as Melerio di Meler, so an immediate bond was struck. Astrid was grateful to find someone in Paris who understood her exacting tastes and was willing to indulge her capricious hunt for rare pieces that might have once belonged to the Princesse de Lamballe. Stephen, however, knew immediately that this girl had to be the daughter of some big shot, though it took him another 3 years of careful cultivating to figure out exactly who she was. Like many of the world's greatest jewelry dealers, from Gianni Bulgari to Lawrence Graff, Stephen had over the years honed his skills in being perfectly attuned to the whims of the very rich. He had become a consummate soothsayer to the Asian billionaire set, and he had become an expert in recognizing Astrid's many-faceted moods. He could tell, simply by observing her reactions to the types of pieces he would present to her, what sort of day she was having. Today, he was seeing a side to Astrid he had never witnessed in 15 years of knowing her. Something was clearly wrong, and her mood had worsened dramatically while he was showing her a new series of bracelets by Carnet. "Aren't these the most intricately detailed bracelets you've ever seen? They look like they could have been inspired by the botanical drawings of Alexander von Humboldt. Speaking of bracelets, did you like the charm bracelet your husband bought you?" Astrid looked up at Stephen, confused by his question.
"The charm bracelet?"
"Yes, the one Michael got you for your birthday last month." "Wait a minute, didn't you know he got it from me?"
Astrid averted her gaze, not wanting to look surprised. She had not received any sort of gift from her husband. Her birthday wasn't until August, and Michael knew better than to ever buy her jewelry. She could feel all the blood rush to her face.
"Oh, yes, I forgot. It's adorable," she said lightly.
"Did you help him pick it out?"
"Yes, he came in one night, all in a hurry. He had such a hard time making up his mind. I think he was afraid you wouldn't like it."
"Well, of course I do. Thanks so much for helping him out," Astrid said, keeping her face completely calm. Oh, God. Oh, God. Oh, God. Was Michael actually stupid enough to buy jewelry for someone else from her close friend, Stephen Chia? Stephen wished he hadn't brought up the bracelet. He suspected that Astrid had not been impressed with the gift from her husband. Truth be told, he wasn't sure Astrid would ever wear something as quotidian as a bracelet with multicolored pavé diamond teddy bear charms. But it was one of the least expensive things he had in the shop, and he knew that Michael, a typically clueless husband, was making a great effort to find something within his budget. It was quite a sweet gesture, really. But now, within 20 minutes of being at his shop, Astrid had already bought an extremely rare 3-carat blue diamond set on a Diamond Eternity band that had just arrived from Antwerp, Art Deco cufflinks that had once belonged to Clark Gable, a signed vintage Cartier platinum and diamond link bracelet, and she was seriously considering a fantastical pair of VBH earrings. It was a piece he had brought in to show her for the sheer folly of it, and he would never have imagined her to be interested. The pear-shaped stones are kunzites weighing 49 carats, and these remarkable sparkling discs are 23-carat ice diamonds, a highly original treatment. Are you thinking of wearing something new to the coup wedding next weekend? He asked, trying to make conversation with his unusually focused shopper. Maybe, Astrid replied, staring into the mirror and scrutinizing the multicolored gemstones dangling off the enormous earrings, the bottoms of which were brushing against her shoulders. The piece reminded her of a Native American dream catcher. It's such a dramatic look, isn't it? Very Millicent Rogers, I think. What kind of dress are you planning to wear? I haven't really decided yet, she said, almost mumbling to herself. She wasn't really looking at the earrings. In her mind, all she could picture was a piece of jewelry from her husband hanging off some other woman's wrist. First came the text message, then the receipt from Petrus. Now there was an expensive charm bracelet. Three's a charm.
Well, I think you'd want to go with something dead simple if you wear these earrings, Stephen added.
He was getting a bit concerned. The girl was not being herself today. Usually she would breeze in, and they would spend the first hour chatting and munching on the delicious homemade pineapple tarts she always brought before he took out anything to show her. After another hour or so of looking at pieces, she might hand one thing over to him and say, "Okay, I'm going to think about this one," before blowing a kiss goodbye. She was not the sort of client who spent $1 million in 10 minutes. And yet, Stephen always cherished her visits. He loved her sweet nature, her impeccable manners, and her complete lack of pretension. It was so refreshing, not like the sort of ladies he usually had to deal with, the egos that required constant stroking. He enjoyed reminiscing with Astrid about their crazy younger days in Paris, and he admired the originality of her taste. She cared about the quality of the stones, of course, but she couldn't have cared less about the size and was never interested in the ostentatious pieces. Why would she need to be when her mother already had one of the grandest jewelry collections in Singapore, while her grandmother, Shang Suyi, possessed a trove of jewels so legendary he had only ever heard them mentioned in hushed whispers? Ming Dynasty jade like you've never seen before. Jewels from the Tsars that Shang Lungma cunningly bought from the Grand Duchess's fleeing into Shanghai during the Bolshevik Revolution. Wait till the old lady dies. Your friend Astrid is the favorite granddaughter, and she's going to inherit some of the most unparalleled pieces in the world, Stephen had been told by the acclaimed art historian Huang Pengfan, one of the few people who had ever witnessed the splendor of the Shang collection. You know what? I must have these earrings, too, Astrid declared, standing up and smoothing out her short pleated skirt.
Are you leaving already? Don't you want a Diet Coke?
Stephen asked in surprise.
No, thank you, not today. I think I need to hurry off so many errands. Do you mind if I take the cufflinks now? Promise I'll have the funds transferred to your account by the end of day.
My dear, don't be silly. You can have everything now. Let me just get you some nice boxes.
Stephen left the room thinking that the last time Astrid had been impulsive like this was after her breakup with Charlie Wu. Was there trouble in paradise? Astrid walked back to her car in the parking garage of the mall. She unlocked the door, got in, and placed the black and cream-colored parchment shopping bag,
subtly embossed with Stephen Chia jewels, on the passenger seat beside her. She sat in the airless vehicle, which was getting more stifling by the second. She could feel her heart pounding so quickly. She had just bought a $350,000 diamond ring she didn't much care for, a $28,000 bracelet she quite liked, and a $784,000 pair of earrings that made her look like Pocahontas. For the first time in weeks, she felt bloody fantastic. Then she remembered the cufflinks. She rummaged through the bag, searching for the box that contained the Art Deco cufflinks she had purchased for Michael. They were in a blue velvet vintage box, and she stared at the pair of little silver and cobalt cufflinks fastened against a satin lining that had long since become mottled with pale yellow spots. These had once brushed against Clark Gable's wrists, Astrid thought. The gorgeous, romantic Clark Gable. Hadn't he been married several times? Surely he must have romanced many women in his time. Surely he must have cheated on his wives, even Caro Lombard. How could anyone ever want to cheat on a woman as beautiful as Caro Lombard? But sooner or later, it was bound to happen. Every man cheats. This is Asia. Every guy has mistresses, girlfriends, flings on the side. It's a normal thing. A status thing. Get used to it. Great-grandpa had dozens of concubines. Uncle Freddy had that whole other family in Taiwan. And how many mistresses has Cousin Eddie had by now? I've lost count. It was all meaningless. Guys just need a cheap thrill, a quick shag. They need to go on the hunt. It's a primal thing. They need to spread their seed. They need to put their pricks inside things. Miss you inside me. No, no, no. It was nothing serious. Probably some girl he met on his work trip. A fancy dinner, a one-night stand. And he bought her off with a bracelet. A silly charm bracelet, so cliché. At least he was discreet. At least he went and screwed the girl in Hong Kong, not Singapore. Many wives have to put up with so much more. Think of some of my friends. Think of what Fiona Tung has to go through with Eddie. The humiliation. I am lucky. I am so lucky. Don't be so bourgeois. It's just a fling. Don't make this a big deal. Remember, grace under pressure. Grace under pressure. Grace Kelly slept with Clark Gable while they were filming Mogambo. Michael is as handsome as Clark Gable, and now he will have Gable's cufflinks, and he will love them. They weren't too expensive. He won't get mad. He will love me. He still loves me. He hasn't been that distant. He's just stressed out. All that work pressure. We'll be married 5 years this October. Oh, my God. Not even 5 years and he is already cheating. He isn't attracted to me anymore. I'm getting too old for him. He's tired of me. Poor Cassian. What's going to happen to Cassian? My life is over. It's all over. This isn't happening. I can't believe this is happening. To me. Chapter 16. The Goes. Singapore. Rachel peered at the clock and figured that she'd only slept about 5 hours, but it was dawn and she was too excited to go back to sleep. Nick was snoring softly beside her. She looked around at the room, wondering how much this hotel must be costing Nick per night. It was an elegant suite decorated in understated pale wood, the only burst of color coming from the fuchsia orchids on the console table against the mirrored wall. Rachel got out of bed, put on a plush pair of terry cloth slippers, and padded quietly into the bathroom to splash some water on her face. Then she walked over to the window and peeked through the curtains. Outside was a perfectly manicured garden with a large, inviting swimming pool lined with deck chairs. A man in a white and teal uniform was walking around the pool with a long pole and net, meditatively fishing out the stray leaves that had settled on the surface of the water during the night. The garden was set within a quadrangle of poolside rooms, and just beyond the serenity of the low-rise Victorian structure rose a cluster of high-rise buildings, reminding her that they were in the heart of Singapore's fashionable Orchard Road district. Rachel could already feel the early morning heat permeating through the double-pane windows. She closed the curtains and went into the sitting room to rummage for her laptop. After logging on, she began to draft an email to her friend Paik Lin. Seconds later, an instant message popped up on her screen.
Go, PL.
You're awake? Are you really here?
Me. Sure am. Go, PL. Yippee! Me. It's not even 7 and already so hot. Go, PL.
This is nothing. Are you staying at Nick's parents?
Me. No. We're at Kingsford Hotel. Go, PL.
Nice. Very central. But why are you at a hotel?
Me. Nick's parents are out of town and he wanted to be at a hotel during wedding week.
Go, PL.
Dot, dot, dot. Me. But secretly, I think he didn't want to show up at his parents' house with me on the very first night. LOL. Go, PL.
Smart guy. So, can I see you today?
Me. Today's great. Nick's busy helping the groom.
Go, PL. Is he the wedding planner? LOL. Meet up at noon? At your lobby?
Me. Perfect. Can't wait to see you. Go, PL.
XOXO.
At noon sharp, Go Paik Lin came walking up the wide staircase of the Kingsford Hotel, and heads turned as she entered the grand lobby. With her broad nose, round face, and slightly squinty eyes, she was not a natural-born raving beauty, but she was one of those girls who really knew how to make the most out of what she had. And what she had was a voluptuous body and the confidence to pull off bold fashion choices. Today, she was wearing a very short white shift dress that hinted at her curves and a pair of strappy gold gladiator sandals. Her long black hair was pulled into a tight, high ponytail, and a pair of gold-rimmed sunglasses were clamped on her forehead like a headband. On her earlobes were 3-carat diamond solitaire studs, and on her wrist, a chunky gold and diamond watch. She finished off the look with a gold mesh tote bag flung casually on her shoulder. She looked like she was ready for the beach club in Saint-Tropez.
Paik Lin! Rachel cried, running toward her with her arms outstretched.
Paik Lin squealed loudly upon seeing her, and the friends hugged tightly.
Look at you! You look terrific!
Rachel exclaimed before turning to introduce Nick.
Great to meet you!
Paik Lin said in a voice that was surprisingly loud for her tiny frame. She gave Nick the once-over.
So, it took a local boy to finally get her out here.
Glad to be of service, Nick said.
I know you're playing wedding planner today, but when do I get to do my CIA debriefing on you? You better promise I'll see you soon, Paik Lin said.
I promise, Nick laughed and kissed Rachel goodbye.
As soon as he was out of earshot, Paik Lin turned to Rachel and raised her eyebrows.
Well, he was easy on the eyes. No wonder he managed to get you to stop working and take a holiday for once in your life.
Rachel just giggled.
Really, you have no right to poach one of our endangered species. So tall, so fit, and that accent. I normally find Singapore boys with posh English accents to be incredibly pretentious, but on him, it just works.
As they walked down the long flight of red-carpeted stairs, Rachel asked, Where are we going for lunch?
My parents have invited you to our house. They are so excited to see you, and I think you'll enjoy some traditional home cooking.
That sounds great. But if I'm going to be seeing your parents, should I change? Rachel asked. She was wearing a white cotton blouse with a pair of khaki slacks.
Oh, you're fine. My parents are so casual, and they know you are traveling.
Waiting for them at the entrance was a large metallic old BMW with tinted windows. The driver quickly got out and opened the door for them. As the car left the hotel grounds and turned onto a busy street, Paik Lin began to point out the sights.
This is the famous Orchard Road, Tourist Central. It's our version of Fifth Avenue.
It's Fifth Avenue on steroids. I've never seen so many boutiques and shopping malls lined up as far as the eye can see.
Yes, but I prefer the shopping in New York or L.A.
You always did, Paik Lin, Rachel teased, remembering her friend's frequent shopping jaunts when she was supposed to be in class. Rachel always knew that Paik Lin came from money. They met during freshman orientation at Stanford, and Paik Lin was the girl who showed up to 8 a.m. classes looking as if she had just come from a shopping spree on Rodeo Drive. As a newly arrived international student from Singapore, one of the first things she did was buy herself a Porsche 911 convertible, claiming that since Porsches were such a bargain in America,
it's an absolute crime not to have one.
She soon found Palo Alto to be too provincial and tried at every opportunity to lure Rachel into skipping class and driving up to San Francisco with her.
The Neiman Marcus there was so much better than the one at Stanford Shopping Center. She was generous to a fault, and Rachel spent most of her college years being showered with gifts, enjoying glorious meals at culinary destinations like Chez Panisse and Post Ranch Inn, and going on weekend spa trips all along the California coast, courtesy of Paiklin's handy American Express black card. Part of Paiklin's charm was that she made no apologies for being loaded. She was completely unabashed when it came to spending money or talking about it. When Fortune Asia magazine did a cover profile on her family's property development and construction company, she proudly forwarded Rachel a link to the article. She threw lavish parties catered by the plumed horse at the townhouse she rented off campus. At Stanford, this did not exactly make her the most popular girl on campus. The East Coast set ignored her, and the low-key Bay Area types found her much too SoCal. Rachel always thought Paiklin would have fit in better at Princeton or Brown, but she was glad that fate had sent her this way. Having grown up under far more modest circumstances, Rachel was intrigued by this free-spending girl, who, while being filthy rich, was never a snob about it. "Has Nick filled you in on the real estate insanity here in Singapore?" Paiklin asked as the car zipped around Newton Circus. "He hasn't. The market is really hot at the moment. Everyone's flipping properties left and right. It's practically become the national sport. See that building under construction on the left? I just bought 2 new flats there last week. I got them at an insider price of 2.1 each."
"Do you mean 2.1 million? Rachel asked.
It always took her a while to get used to the way Paiklin spoke about money. The numbers just seemed so unreal.
"Yes, of course. I got them at the insider price since our company did the construction. The flats are actually worth $3 million, and by the time the building is completed at the end of the year, I can sell each of them for 3.5, 4 mil easy."
"Now, why would the prices shoot up so quickly? Isn't that a sign that the market is in a speculative bubble?" Rachel inquired.
"We are not in a bubble because the demand is real. All the Henwees want to be in real estate these days."
What are Henwees?" Rachel asked.
"Oh, sorry. I forgot you're not up on the lingo. HNWI stands for High Net Worth Individuals. We Singaporeans love to abbreviate everything."
"Yeah, I've noticed that."
"As you may know, there's been an explosion of Henwees from mainland China, and they are the ones really driving up the prices. They are flocking here in droves, buying up properties with golf bags stuffed full of hard cash."
"Really? I thought it was the other way around. Doesn't everyone want to move to China for work?"
"Some, yes, but the super rich Chinese all want to be here. We're the most stable country in the region, and mainlanders feel that their money is far safer here than in Shanghai or even Switzerland."
At this point, the car turned off a main thoroughfare and drove into a neighborhood of tightly packed houses. "So there actually are houses in Singapore," Rachel said.
"Very few. Only about 5% of us are lucky enough to live in houses. This neighborhood is actually one of the first suburban-style developments in Singapore, begun in the 70s, and my family helped to build it," Paiklin explained.
The car drove past a high white wall, over which peaked tall, thick bushes of bougainvillea. A large gold plaque on the wall was engraved Villa d'Oro, and as the car pulled up to the entrance, a pair of ornate golden gates parted to reveal an imposing facade that bore a not-so-accidental resemblance to the Petit Trianon at Versailles, except that the house itself took up most of the lot, and the front portico was dominated by a massive four-tiered marble fountain with a golden swan spouting water from its long, upturned beak.
"Welcome to my home," Paiklin said.
"My God, Paiklin!" Rachel gasped in awe. "Is this where you grew up?"
"This was the property, but my parents tore down the old house and built this mansion about 6 years ago."
"No wonder you thought your townhouse in Palo Alto was so cramped."
"You know, when I was growing up, I thought that everyone lived like this. In the States, this house is probably worth only about $3 million. Can you guess how much it's worth here?"
"I won't even try to guess."
$30 million, easy. And that's just for the land. The house itself would be a teardown."
"Well, I can only imagine how valuable land must be on an island with, what, 4 million people?
More like 5 million now."
The cathedral-sized front door was opened by an Indonesian girl in a frilly black and white French maid's uniform. Rachel found herself standing in a circular entrance foyer with white and rose marble floors radiating out in a sunburst pattern. To the right, an enormous staircase with gold balustrades wound its way to the upper floors. The entire curved wall going up the staircase was a frescoed replica of Fragonard's The Swing, except that this recreation was blown up to fill a 40-foot rotunda.
"A team of artists from Prague camped out for 3 months to paint the frescoes," Paiklin said as she led Rachel up a short flight of steps into the formal living room. "This is my mother's recreation of the Hall of Mirrors at Versailles. Get ready," she warned.
Rachel ascended the steps and entered the room, her eyes widening a little. Aside from the red velvet brocade sofas, every single object in the cavernous formal living room appeared to be made of gold. The vaulted ceiling was composed of layers upon layers of gold leaf. The Baroque console tables were gilt gold. The Venetian mirrors and candelabra lining the walls were gold. The elaborate tassels on the gold damask curtains were yet a deeper shade of gold. Even the tchotchkes scattered around every available surface were golden. Rachel was completely dumbstruck. To make matters even more surreal, the middle of the room was dominated by an enormous oval pond-cum-aquarium sunken into the gold-flecked marble floor. The pond was brightly lit, and for a second, Rachel thought she could make out baby sharks swimming in the bubbling water. Before she could process the scene fully, three golden-haired Pekingese ran into the room, their high-pitched yaps echoing loudly against the marble. Paiklin's mother, a short, plumpish woman in her early 50s with a shoulder-length bouffant perm, entered the room. She wore a tight, shocking pink silk blouse that stretched against her ample cleavage, belted with a chain of interlinked gold Medusa heads, and a tight pair of black trousers. The only thing incongruous about the outfit was the pair of cushioned pink slippers on her feet.
"Astor, Trump, Vanderbilt, naughty, naughty boy, stop barking," she admonished.
"Rachel Chu, welcome, welcome," she cried in her heavy Chinese-accented English.
Rachel found herself crushed into a fleshy hug, the heady scent of Eau d'Adrian filling her nose.
"Aya, so long I haven't seen you. Biancarani suya," she exclaimed in Hokkien, cupping Rachel's cheeks with both hands.
"She thinks you've become very pretty," Paiklin translated, knowing that Rachel only spoke Mandarin.
"Thank you, Mrs. Go. It's so nice to see you again," Rachel said, feeling rather overwhelmed. She never knew what to say when someone complimented her looks.
"Wah?" the woman said in mock horror. "Don't call me Mrs. Go. Mrs. Go is my horrible mother-in-law. Call me Auntie Nina."
"Okay, Auntie Nina."
Come to the kitchen. Makan time."
She clamped her bronze fingernails onto Rachel's wrist, leading her down a long marble-columned hallway toward the dining room. Rachel couldn't help but notice the enormous canary diamond flashing on her hand, like a translucent egg yolk, and the pair of 3-carat solitaires in her earlobes, identical to Paiklin's. Like mother, like daughter. Maybe they got a 2-for-1 deal. The baronial dining hall was somewhat of a respite after the rococo hell of the living room, with its wood boiserie walls and windows overlooking the lawn where a large oval swimming pool was encircled by Grecian sculptures. Rachel quickly registered 2 versions of the Venus de Milo, one in white marble, another in gold, of course. There was a huge round dining table that seated 18 comfortably, covered with a heavy Battenberg lace tablecloth and high-backed Louis XIV chairs that were, thankfully, upholstered in a royal blue brocade. Assembled in the dining room was the entire Go family.
"Rachel, you remember my father? This is my brother, Paikwing, and his wife, Cheryl, and my younger brother, Paikting, whom we call Petey. And these are my nieces, Alyssa and Camilla."
Everyone went around shaking hands with Rachel, who couldn't help but notice that not one of them happened to be over 5'5". The brothers were both much darker complexion than Paiklin, but they all shared the same pixie-ish features. Both were dressed in almost identical outfits of pale blue button-down dress shirts and dark gray slacks, as if they had adhered exactly to a company manual on how to dress for casual Fridays. Cheryl, who was much paler, stuck out from the rest of the family. She wore a pink floral tank top and a short denim skirt, looking rather frazzled as she fussed over her two young daughters, who were both being fed chicken McNuggets, the paper boxes placed on heavy gold-rimmed Limoges plates, along with the packets of sweet and sour dipping sauce. Paiklin's father gestured for Rachel to take the seat next to him. He was a stocky, barrel-chested man in khaki trousers and a red Ralph Lauren shirt, the kind with the oversized Polo Player logo in dark navy emblazoned across the front. His clothes, coupled with his short stature, made him appear incongruously boyish for a man in his late 50s. On his small wrist was a chunky Franck Muller watch, and he too was wearing a pair of cushioned slippers over his socks.
"Rachel Chu, long time no see. We are so very grateful for all the help you gave Paiklin back in her uni days. Without you, she would have been gone case at Stanford," he said.
"Oh, that's not true. Paiklin was a great help to me. I am so honored to be invited to your incredible house for lunch, Mr. Goh," Rachel said graciously.
"Uncle Wai Moon, please call me Uncle Wai Moon," he said.
Three maids entered, adding plates of steaming food to a table already laden with dishes. Rachel counted a total of 13 different dishes laid out on the table.
"Okay, everybody, jack, jack. Don't stand on ceremony. Rachel Chu, this is simple lunch. Simple food la," Nina said.
Rachel stared down at the heaving platters that looked anything but simple.
"Our new cook is from Ipoh, so today you are getting some typical Malaysian dishes and Singapore dishes," Nina continued, dishing a heaping portion of beef rendang curry onto Rachel's gold-rimmed plate.
"Mama, we are done eating. Can we go to the playroom now?"
one of the little girls asked Cheryl.
"You are not done. I still see a few chicken nuggets left," their mother said.
Nina looked over and scolded.
"Ayoh, finish everything on your plate, girls. Don't you know there are children starving in America?"
Rachel grinned at the girls with their adorable twin ponytails and said, "I'm so happy to meet the whole family at last. Does nobody have to work today?"
"This is the advantage of working for your own company. We can take long lunch breaks," PT said.
"Hey, not too long," Wai Mun growled jovially.
"So, all your children work for your company, Mr. Goh? I mean, Uncle Wai Moon?" Rachel asked.
"Yes, yes. This is a true family business. My father is still active as the chairman, and I'm the CEO. All my children have different management roles. Pik Wing is the VP in charge of project development, PT is VP in charge of construction, and Paiklin is VP in charge of new business. Of course, we also have about 6,000 full-time employees between all our offices."
"And where are your offices?" Rachel inquired.
"Our main hubs are Singapore, Hong Kong, Beijing, and Chongqing, but we're starting satellite offices in Hanoi and very soon Yangon."
"Sounds like you're really pushing into all the high-growth regions," Rachel commented, impressed.
"For sure, for sure," Wai Mun said. "Aiya, you're so smart. Paiklin told me you are doing very well at NYU. Are you single? PT, PT, why aren't you paying more attention to Rachel? We can add one more family member to the payroll."
Everyone at the table laughed.
"Papa, you're so forgetful. I told you she was here with her boyfriend," Paiklin chided.
"Ang Mora?" he asked, looking at Paiklin.
"No, Singapore boy. I met him earlier today," Paiklin said.
"Aiya, why isn't he here?" Nina admonished.
"Nick wanted to meet you, but he had to help his friend with some last-minute errands. We're actually here for his friend's wedding. He's going to be the best man," Rachel explained.
"Who's getting married?" Wai Moon asked.
"His name's Colin Koo," Rachel replied. Everyone abruptly stopped eating and stared at her.
"Colin Koo and Araminta Lee?" Cheryl asked, trying to clarify.
"Yes," Rachel said in surprise. "Do you know them?" Nina slammed her chopsticks down on the table and stared at Rachel.
"What? You're going to Colin Koo's wedding?" she screeched, her mouth full of food.
"Yes, yes, are you going too?"
"Rachel, you didn't tell me you were coming for Colin Koo's wedding," Paiklin said in a hushed tone.
You didn't ask," Rachel said uncomfortably.
I don't understand. Is there a problem? She suddenly feared that the Goes might be mortal enemies of the Koos.
No! Paiklin cried, suddenly getting very excited. Don't you know? It's the wedding of the year. It's been covered on every channel, in every magazine, and in about a billion blogs.
Why? Are they famous? Rachel asked, completely baffled.
A la mak! Colin Koo is Koo Tek Fong's grandson. He comes from one of the richest families in the world, and Araminta Lee, she's the supermodel daughter of Peter Lee, one of China's richest men, and Annabelle Lee, the luxury hotel queen. This is like royal wedding!
Nina gushed.
I had no idea, Rachel said in astonishment. I just met them last night.
You met them? You met Araminta Lee? Is she as beautiful in person? What was she wearing?
Cheryl asked, seemingly starstruck. She was very pretty, yes, but so simple. She was literally wearing pajamas when I met her. She looked like a schoolgirl. Is she Eurasian?
No, but her mum is from Xinjiang, so she has Uyghur blood, so they say, Nina said.
Araminta is our most celebrated fashion icon. She has modeled for all the magazines, and she was one of Alexander McQueen's favorite models, Cheryl continued breathlessly.
She's a total babe, P.T. chimed in.
When did you meet her? Paiklin asked.
She was with Colin. They picked us up at the airport.
They picked you up at the airport?
P.T. exclaimed in disbelief, laughing hysterically.
Was there an army of bodyguards?
Not at all. They came in an SUV. Actually, there were two SUVs. One took the luggage straight to the hotel. No wonder, Rachel recalled.
Rachel, Colin Koo's family owns the Kingsford Hotel. That's why you're staying there,
Paiklin said, jabbing her arm excitedly. Rachel didn't quite know what to say. She found herself amused and a little embarrassed by all the excitement.
Your boyfriend is Colin Koo's best man? What's his name? Paiklin's father demanded.
Nicholas Young, Rachel replied.
Nicholas Young. How old is he?
32.
That's 1 year above Pick Wing, Nina said.
She looked up at the ceiling as if racking through her mental Rolodex to see if she could recall a Nicholas Young.
Pick Wing. Ever heard of Nicholas Young?
Wai Moon asked his eldest son.
Nope. Do you know which school he went to?
Pick Wing asked Rachel. Balliol College, Oxford, she replied hesitantly. She wasn't sure why they were suddenly so interested in every minute detail.
No, I mean, which primary school? Paikwing said.
Elementary school, Paiklin clarified.
Oh, I have no idea.
Nicholas Young.
Sounds like an ACS boy, P.T. chimed in. All those Anglo-Chinese schoolboys have Christian names.
Colin Koo went to ACS. Daddy, I already tried to check Nick out when Rachel first started dating him, but no one I know has ever heard of him, Paiklin added.
Nick and Colin went to elementary school together. They have been best friends since childhood, Rachel said.
What is his father's name? Wai Moon asked.
I don't know.
Well, if you find out the parents' names, we can tell you whether he comes from a good family or not, Wai Moon said.
A la mak, of course he's from good family if he's best friends with Colin Koo, Nina said.
Young.
Cheryl, isn't there a gynae named Richard Young, the one who practices with Dr. Toh?
No, Nick's father is an engineer. I think he works in Australia part of the year, Rachel offered.
Well, see if you can find out more about his background and we can help you, Wai Moon finally said.
Oh, you really don't have to do that. It's not important to me what sort of family he comes from, Rachel said.
Nonsense, La, of course it's important,
Wai Moon was adamant.
If he's Singaporean, I have a responsibility to make sure he's good enough for you.
Chapter 17. Nicholas and Colin. Singapore. Among Singapore's upper crust, only two boys' schools matter, Anglo-Chinese School and Raffles Institution. Both are consistently ranked among the top schools in the world and have enjoyed a long-heated rivalry. Raffles, known as RI, established in 1823, is known to attract the brainy crowd, while ACS, established in 1886, is popular with the more fashionable set and somewhat perceived to be a breeding ground for snobs. Much of this had to do with the 1980 article in the Sunday Nation entitled The Little Horrors of ACS, which exposed the rampant snobbery among its pampered students. This led to a Shane principal announcing to stunned students the very next morning during assembly that, henceforth, students were no longer allowed to be dropped off at the front entrance by their chauffeurs. They had to walk up the short driveway all by themselves unless it was raining. Expensive watches, eyeglasses, fountain pens, briefcases, satchels, pencil boxes, stationery, combs, electronic gadgets, comic books, and any other luxury items would also be banned from school property. Nick and Colin, of course, attended the school long after this scandal had passed, and perhaps out of nostalgia, liked to meet up at the coffee shop of their old alma mater on Barker Road. Located in the sports complex between the main pool and the basketball courts, the ACS coffee shop served a motley selection of Thai and Singaporean dishes, as well as such oddities as British beef pies, which Nick loved. Back when the two of them were on the swim team, they would always grab a bite after practice at the tuck shop, as they called it. The original cooks had long since retired. The legendary Mi Siam was no longer on the menu, and the coffee shop itself wasn't even in the original space, having long since been torn down during the redevelopment of the sports center. But for Nick and Colin, it was still the place to meet whenever they were both in town. Colin had already ordered his lunch by the time Nick arrived. "Sorry I'm late," Nick said, patting him on the back as he got to the table. "I had to swing by my grandmother's." Colin did not look up from his plate of salted fried chicken, so Nick continued. "So, what else do we have to do today? The Tuxes are in from London, and I'm just waiting to hear back from some of the last-minute people about the rehearsal next week." Colin clamped his eyes shut and grimaced. "Can we please talk about something besides this fucking wedding?" "Okay, then. What do you want to talk about?" Nick asked calmly, realizing that Colin had hit one of his down days. The cheerful, life-of-the-party Colin of the night before had vanished. Colin didn't respond. "Did you get any sleep last night?" Nick asked. Colin remained silent. There was no one else in the place, and the only sounds were the occasional muffled shouts of players on the basketball court next door and the clatter of dishes being washed every time the lone waiter walked in and out of the kitchen. Nick leaned back into his seat, patiently waiting for Colin to make the next move. To the society pages, Colin was known as Asia's billionaire bachelor jock, famed not only for being the scion of one of Asia's great fortunes, but also as one of Singapore's top-ranked swimmers back in his college days. He was celebrated for his exotic good looks and debonair style, his string of romances with local starlets, and his ever-expanding collection of contemporary art. With Nick, however, Colin had the freedom to be his true self. Nick, who had known him since childhood, was probably the only person on the planet who didn't give a damn about his money, and more important, the only one who was there during what they both referred to as the war years. For beneath the wide grin and the charismatic personality, Colin struggled with a severe anxiety disorder and crippling depression, and Nick was one of the few people allowed to witness this side of him. It was as if Colin bottled up all of his pain and anguish for months at a time, unleashing it on Nick whenever he was in town. To anyone else, this would have been an intolerable situation, but Nick was so used to this by now, he almost didn't recall a time when Colin wasn't swinging between the highest of highs and the lowest of lows. This was just a prerequisite of being Colin's best friend. The waiter, a sweaty teenager in a soccer t-shirt who didn't look old enough to pass child labor laws, approached the table to take Nick's order. "I'll have the beef curry pie, please, and a Coke, extra ice." Colin finally broke his silence. "As always, beef curry pie and Coke, extra ice. You never change, do you?"
"What can I tell you? I know what I like," Nick said simply.
"Even though you always like this exact same thing, you can always change your mind whenever you wish. That's the difference between us. You still have choices."
"Come on, that's not true. You can choose."
"Nicky, I haven't been in the position to make a single choice since I was born, and you know that."
Colin said matter-of-factly.
It's a good thing I actually want to marry Araminta. I just don't know how I'll make it through the Broadway production, that's all. I have this perverse fantasy of kidnapping her, jumping on a plane, and marrying her at some little 24-hour chapel in the middle of nowhere, Nevada.
So, why not do it? The wedding isn't until next week, but if you're already this miserable, why not call it off?
You know this merger has been choreographed down to the most minute detail, and this is how it's going to be. It's good for business, and anything that's good for business is good for the family, Colin said bitterly. Anyway, I don't want to dwell on the inevitable anymore. Let's talk about last night. How was I? Sufficiently cheery for Rachel, I hope?
Rachel loved you. It was a nice surprise to be welcomed like that, but you know, you don't ever have to put on a show for her.
I don't? What have you told her about me? Colin asked wearily.
I haven't told her anything besides the fact that you once had an unhealthy obsession with Kristen Scott Thomas.
Colin laughed. Nick was relieved. It was a sign that the clouds were dissipating.
You didn't tell her about how I tried to stalk Kristen in Paris, did you? Colin continued.
No, I wasn't going to give her any more opportunities to back out of this trip by giving her full insight into my weird friends.
Speaking of weird, could you believe how nice Araminta was being to Rachel?
I think you're underestimating Araminta's ability to be nice.
Well, you know how she normally is with new people, but I think she wants to keep you on her side. And she could see that I liked Rachel instantly.
I'm so glad, Nick smiled.
To be quite honest, I thought I might be slightly jealous of her at first, but I think she's great. She's not clingy, and she's so refreshingly American. You do realize that everyone is talking about you and Rachel, right? Everyone is already taking bets on the wedding date.
Nick sighed. Colin, I'm not thinking about my wedding right now. I'm thinking about yours. I'm just trying to live in the here and now.
So, speaking of the here and now, when are you going to introduce Rachel to your grandmother?
I was thinking tonight. That's why I want to see my grandmother to get Rachel invited to dinner.
I'll say a little prayer,
Colin quipped as he finished his last chicken wing.
He knew how momentous it was for Nick's famously reclusive grandmother to invite a virtual stranger into her house.
You do realize that everything's going to change the minute you take Rachel into that house, don't you?
Funny. Astrid said the same thing. You know, Rachel is not expecting anything. She's never put any pressure on me when it comes to marriage. In fact, we've never even discussed it.
No, no, that's not what I mean, Colin tried to clarify. It's just that the two of you have been living this idyllic fantasy, the simple young lovers in Greenwich Village life. Up until now, you've been the guy struggling to get tenure. Don't you think she's in for quite a shock tonight?
What do you mean? I am struggling to get tenure, and I don't see how Rachel meeting my grandmother will change things.
Come on, Nikki, don't be naive! The minute she walks into that house, it will affect your relationship. I'm not saying that things are going to be bad necessarily, but an innocence will be lost. You won't be able to go back to the way it was before, that's for sure. No matter what, you'll forever be transformed in her eyes, just like all my former girlfriends the minute they found out I was that Colin Koo. I'm only trying to prepare you a bit.
Nick pondered what Colin had just said for a while. I think you're wrong, Colin. First of all, our situations are so completely different. My family isn't like yours. You've been groomed since day one to be the future CEO of the coup organization, but nothing of the sort exists in my family. We don't even have a family business. And yes, I might have well-to-do cousins and all that, but you know my situation isn't like theirs. I'm not like Astrid, who inherited all her great-aunt's money, or my shine cousins.
Colin shook his head.
Nikki, Nikki, this is why I love you. You are the only person in all of Asia who doesn't realize how rich you are. Or should I say, how rich you will be one day. Here, hand over your wallet.
Nick was puzzled, but he took his well-worn brown leather wallet out of his back pocket and handed it to Colin.
You'll see I have about $50 inside.
Colin fished out Nick's New York State driver's license and held it in front of his face.
Tell me, what this says.
Nick rolled his eyes but played along. Nicholas A. Young.
Yes. That's it. Young. Now, out of your entire family, are there any other male cousins with this surname?
No.
My point exactly.